And now to do our introduction, please give a warm welcome to tonight's program chair, Christine, oh, and I didn't ask you to say your last name. Scrivani. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth. Now we'll begin the program for our radio and internet audience. Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, presented in partnership with the Lafayette Library and Learning Center's Glenn Seaborg Learning Consortium. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Christine Scrivani, Regional Banking Sales Coach for Greater Bay at Wells Fargo Bank and your chair for the program. Tonight's program is sponsored by Wells Fargo and is part of the Good Lit series underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. Here to celebrate the Bay Area food scene, we're joined by two powerhouse chefs, Joanne Weir and Gary Danko. Some of you may already know, I have to do my announcement, sorry, that Wells Fargo is headquartered in San Francisco. Wells Fargo has approximately 265,000 team members, and we serve one in three households in the U.S. We are proud to support this event. The reason we support these efforts is that Wells Fargo cares deeply about our local communities where our team members live, work, and do business. We've had a strong commitment to our local communities since our company's founding more than 160 years ago in San Francisco. And I'm honored to be here to, as a cook as well, to witness these two chefs. Joanne Weir is a James Beard Award-winning cookbook author, cooking teacher, host, and executive producer for the award-winning PBS TV series, Joanne Weir Gets Fresh. She is chef, owner of Copita, a tequilaria and restaurant in Sausalito, and she spent 5 years cooking at Chez Panisse after receiving a Master Chef diploma with Madeline Kamen. In 2012, Joanne was also appointed by Hillary Clinton and the State Department to the American Chef Corporation, one of 20 women chosen to promote world relations through food. The author of 17 cookbooks, Joanne's newest book is Kitchen Gypsy, Recipes and Stories from a Lifelong Romance with Food. Gary Danko is widely recognized as one of America's most talented and respected chefs. The winner of 3 James Beard Foundation Awards, Danko first opened his restaurant, Gary Danko, in 1999, receiving the highest accolades possible from both San Francisco Daily Newspapers and his third selection in Esquire Magazine's annual Best New Restaurants and 6th ExxonMobil Travel Guide 5-star, as well as AAA 5-diamond ratings. In May of 2000, Gary Danko won the James Beard Foundation's Best New Restaurant Award, and in August of that year, Danko was named Chef of the Year by San Francisco Magazine. Tonight, Chef Weir and Chef Danko will discuss Chef Weir's latest cookbook, Kitchen Gypsy, and take a trip down Chef Weir's culinary memory lane, sharing stories from her days cooking with Alice Waters at Chez Panisse, traveling and teaching throughout Europe, and becoming the California chef she is today. Please join me in welcoming Chef Joanne Weir and Chef Gary Danko.
Thank you, Christine, and welcome everybody. We're proud to be here, and actually Joanne and I have done this before in San Francisco, so they wanted us in Lafayette this year. So we have basically an hour today, and Joanne and I have very little to talk about. We chewed the fat all the way here. But anyhow, I'm going to sort of start immediately. Basically, this book is about your life and how you came to love food and really where it has brought you today. So we're going to kind of jump to chapter 6, which is where Joanne and I meet through this common bond, a woman, very talented woman named Madeline Kamen. So 30 years ago, Joanne and I met in Glen, New Hampshire at Madeline Kamen's cooking school and restaurant called Auberge Madeleine. So Joanne, I had graduated the class before, and you had taken classes with Madeline before that in Newton Center. So Joanne and I became fast and furious friends, and then next thing I know, she has graduated, and I am the chef at Behringer, and in walks Joanne Weir with good news. She had just been accepted at Chez Panisse, so, right. Yep. Which was an incredible, and, you know, First of all, where have the 30 years gone?
Oh, wow. Did you have to tell them? I thought we
Well, that's what the book's for.
You could have
for,
just right? said 15 years.
But anyhow, you know, Joan and I have traveled the world, and I'm not going to really get into her book. I'm sure she will that, but I'm going to talk about things that aren't in the book because I want you to read the book. you know, basically, I was Joanne's surrogate husband for years, why we found her the perfect man, and I think we did a great job. She's married to Joe, who's a lawyer and very incredible, and so, but you know, basically, Joanne, you grew up in Massachusetts on a farm.
So, actually, my grandparents on both sides had farms, and this is chapter one. And I had this very, like you, I mean, you had delicious food growing up, too, but both of my grandparents had farms. And it's funny because, writing a book like this, I really thought that, I'll just write my story. And little did I know, it was such a cathartic thing to do because I really looked back at my life. And one of my most vivid memories is really going to my grandparents, my grandfather on my mother's side. And he had this incredible dairy farm in the Berkshires of Massachusetts. And we would go every Saturday with my mom. She'd load us into the car and we'd go to my grandparents. And we really loved going, but my grandfather, I'm a fourth generation professional cook, so my grandfather was my great grandmother. And so we would have these lunches and he would have butchered the chicken, he made homemade mayonnaise, he made the rolls, my favorite thing, and to this day still, is potato chips, and I'm convinced it's because he used to make us these homemade potato chips. And so we would be sitting, you know, having this picnic outside underneath the maple trees. And for dessert, what did we have? He would hand churn maple walnut ice cream. He even made the maple syrup. So I grew up with this kind of food, which I thought everybody had that food. Seriously, until I went to school and saw what other kids were bringing to school.
Do you remember loving the food back then? We have similar backgrounds. My mother grew up in Louisiana, so we would go to the farm in Louisiana. Right. And I grew up in upstate New York, and we were used to salted butter. So we get down to grandma's house, and they have churned butter, and it has no salt in it. And we're like, ew, this is terrible, you know. And now you look back now, and you would kill for that butter.
Oh, that butter. Because my other grandmother, it's really funny because my grandparents on my mother's side were very different. It was only 13 miles away, but my grandparents on my father's side came from Lithuania. And that was very different. I felt like I was going to the old country when we went there. My grandmother was as wide as she was tall. She wore these dresses down to here, these big chunky black shoes. And she made incredible food, but it was like sauerkraut and braised pork, but everything, same thing. She made her own sauerkraut. They had the pigs that they were butchering. So I did grow up with just unbelievable food. And
the original farm to garden child.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. But you know, what I really thought about was, it was really kind of logical that I would go, and I'm not trying to jump ahead or anything, but that I would work at a place like Chez Panisse, because really my grandfather was, you know, all the principles we are talking about now, like sustainability and seasonal and, you know, organic, heirloom, all those things were, you know, things that he did just naturally without, you know, he didn't talk about those principles, but he lived them.
Very interesting. And you talk about in your book how you went to school and you didn't have the normal tuna fish sandwich that everybody else did, but
I had to suffer through this home. My mother, really, she would say, "I'm going to make you a tomato." I remember this one time she said, "I'm going to make you a tomato sandwich," and I thought, wait a minute, like all the other kids get to have peanut butter and jelly and I've got to have a tomato sandwich. So anyway, she goes out into the garden. My mother was a great gardener too, and of course she got that from my grandfather. But she goes out into the garden and she picks this tomato, she brings it in, she's holding it seriously like it's a baby or something. It's really like gently holding this tomato. She toasts the bread, homemade. She spreads it with homemade mayonnaise, and then she slices the tomato and she puts it on top of the bread, right? And then she said, and she sprinkles it with salt, and she goes, "Now, whenever you eat or cook with tomatoes, they always need a little bit of salt because it brings out the sweetness and the acidity." And I'm thinking, I'm 6 years old. Really, like, what am I going to do with that information? It's not like you could go to school the next day saying, listen, look what I learned yesterday. So anyway, my mother put the top on the sandwich. She cut it into two perfect triangles. She hands it to me. And honestly, I took a bite out of the corner of that sandwich. And you know, I mean, it's like the most delicious thing, a tomato sandwich. And I think a chef was born that morning, but or that day for lunch. But
I sometimes have this eternal flavor of those tomatoes of my childhood. And I don't think it's the same today. I don't know.
Are tomatoes what they were like when we were kids? Uh-huh. I don't know. I keep looking for that. But
what was the food that you wanted to eat that your mother, like, we always wanted to have Swanson frozen TV dinners.
Me too.
And my mother would never buy them for us.
Finally,
you know, like kid in the candy shop, you're going to get it and you get it and you're like ready to eat it and you're like, ugh.
No, I know. No, it didn't have any flavor, but I was exactly the same. I mean, honestly, my thing that I really wanted always was I wanted my mother to, I would have killed a kid for a Chips Ahoy cookie. I wanted a Chips Ahoy cookie. I don't know, do they still make Chips Ahoy cookies? I don't even know. But I wanted one so badly, and I had to go to school with homemade cookies. I was so embarrassed to take out my little, you know, those little sandwich bags that were like wax paper?
Uh-huh, exactly.
So I used to take out my, and I'd like hide them. I was so embarrassed. Kids, you know, I'd trade. I would eat those Chips Ahoy. They had no flavor. They tasted like cardboard. We used to go to my aunt's house, and she had a bowl of candy. I'll never forget this, on the table. That, for us, we didn't even have candy like that. If it was, my mother was probably making homemade caramels or something. But seriously, we just sat on the couch just to eat the candy. I'm not kidding. So, yeah.
So when did you actually start helping your mother prepare? You said she liked to cook alone. Was that a concentration?
She didn't read my book. My mother really did. She loved that time in the kitchen alone, and it wasn't really something that we were there helping. I mean, yeah, we'd help her set the table or we'd help her do the dishes, but we didn't cook with her until, and I know you did cook with yours.
The screaming six children.
Yeah, right. No, we only have four. But no, it was really more, oh yeah, really. See, that was yours. But we had four, but my mother did the cooking. And she would always get kind of, if we went into the kitchen and we talked to her, she kind of seemed a little edgy in the kitchen, so we'd kind of stay out of her way.
My mother was always looking for any help she could get.
Oh, she did, yeah. Well, she had a lot to cook for.
She put us to work and, you know, basically gave us two things that I treasure today, work ethic, right. You know, and basically values and you know, what food should taste like. Because my mother was a very good cook with really two simple things that she knew how to use, salt and acid. And, you could fast forward to Madeline Kamen because that's exactly years later what she was teaching.
It's true. And the thing about salt and acid is I always say this to people when they say, what are your two, like, do you have any tricks in the kitchen? And I always say, salt and acid, really. When we say acid, we mean like lemon juice or vinegar. And it really does. You can correct any dish. People always...
Exactly. You know, so let's chat about Madeline. So let's go back. When did you actually pick up a knife and start? Did you peel potatoes?
I'll just tell you one little problem I had in the kitchen. So, like, I was probably about 8 years old, and this is a story. I mean, the book is really, you know, stories about how everything I've done in my life has kind of gotten me to where I sit really at this very minute. But the one story was I was probably about 8 or 9. And I said to my mother, I'm going to make some cookies. I want to make some oatmeal cookies. I'm making those on my own. You can stay in the other room. Watch as the world turns or whatever you do. And or one of those General Hospital, I don't know. But I'm making cookies. And I remember I measured everything out. And I yelled to my mother. I said, hey, Mom, you're going to need to buy some more baking soda. She said, oh, she said, I just got a new box. So anyway, I measured everything out. I had it all out there on the counter, and I was rolling those cookies like perfectly into little round balls. I put them on the baking sheet. They looked perfect. They were really perfect. A little dry, but they were perfect. So I put them in the oven, and I pulled up a chair, turned the light on, you know, the little window, and I'm sitting there, you know, this little kid looking at the cookies. As those cookies cooked, baked, they started to spread across the entire baking sheet, down the sides, and they were making one huge cookie onto the floor of the oven. Mom, you always call somebody, right? You call your mother. You probably never had a single mistake, Gary. That's why he has the most incredible restaurant like on earth. And so anyway, I said, Mom, she came in, and she was like, wow. Honestly, it was one huge big cookie. So we took those out of the oven, and this is how great my mother was. I have to say, I really think that day, you know, I learned a lot because my mother, as we were scraping them into the trash, she said to me, by the way, I should tell you that instead of 1.5 teaspoons, I use 1.5 cups of baking soda. So she said, as she's scraping them in, she took a little bite. I'm sure it was minute. And she said, oh, honey, they still taste good. So anyway, I have a great mom. We both do. We both have moms about the same age.
Let's go to chapter 6, Madeline Kamen, right. And you name this three grains of salt.
I named it three grains of salt because Madeline had the most. She really had a phenomenal palate, don't you think?
Incredible. And mine, too. She had an incredible mind.
Brilliant. Absolutely
brilliant.
Incredible
palate.
Madeline has written many, many books. I mean, her books are like, you know, this thick. And so I named it Three Grains of Salt because I was studying with her that year.
Glen, New Hampshire.
New Hampshire. I arrived in January 11th. I can still remember. I get the chills just thinking about it. We were living in Glen, New Hampshire.
7 miles away.
7 miles away
I've
from the school.
It
was it seven?
It's 7 miles.
Wow. Anyway, we lived we were all pretty much adults. I mean, I was 30, and we were living together in the same house, and you have 8 adults living in the same house. I'll never forget it. And we didn't have cell phones. I sound like it's like really hundreds of years ago. But we didn't have cell phones, and there was one phone in the house, and I got the room outside the kitchen, but the only phone was in the kitchen. It was a wall phone. I was downstairs. And so, yeah, it was just really, I call that, you know, that was really, I almost call that chapter the hardest year in my life. But anyway, but we were with Madeline and we were cooking, like we were making a mousseline or something, very classically French food. And she came up and she tasted it and she goes, it's good, but it needs a little bit of salt. And I swear she put 3 grains of salt and I tasted it and she was right. It was so much better. Maybe she's snuck a teaspoon in there, but I don't think so. So that's why I named it 3 grains of salt, because she was really a taskmaster, extraordinary woman, and really a friend to both of us. She really thought Gary was her son and I was the daughter. I mean, really. I mean, she was good to us.
She was our cooking mother, basically.
She was our cooking mother. It's true. One time we went to the French Laundry. Remember that? When the French Laundry first opened?
Oh, my God.
We went with Madeline. Do you want to tell?
Well, I was thinking about this the other day. We're sitting there, just Joanne, Madeline, myself, and we had just received the foie gras, I think a tureen of foie. And,
yes.
You know, Madeline had rated it in something, and I said some comment, like, we should do something. Do you remember what I said to her?
Oh, she got mad.
Oh, she just like...
Yeah. And and that's sort of how she was.
And so that kind of ended the meal there. You're like, okay.
No, but the other thing was the wine.
Uh-huh.
And so she ordered 2 wines.
She would always do this in class.
Had them wrapped. It was always a class. She had them wrapped up in a napkin, and she poured it into my glass, and I had to guess. Well, I guessed it was a Chardonnay. And she said, I got her. I was so happy. And then she said, but what Chardonnay? And I knew her. I knew her well enough to know that she loved Kistler. And I said, Kistler. And I was right. And she, like, her eyes were bugging out of her head. She was just shocked. And you guessed Cabernet. Uh-huh. You had to guess. Of course, I got the white wine, the female, and you got the red wine.
Crazy. So do you remember your first day of class with Madeline, walking into the little pink curtained little restaurant school?
It was like pink walls with little lace curtains.
It used to be a pizza restaurant, remember? I don't know if you...
Yes.
But anyhow, do you remember that day?
I do remember it because I put a calendar on the wall the very first day. I arrived January 11th, 1985. I can still remember. And it was a 10-month program. It was a master chef class. There were 8 of us in the class. And it was intense because there were first of all, half of us were really excited to be there, and the other half were seriously spending their trust funds and didn't really care about school like we did. And I was very serious about wanting to learn. I was, you know, wanting to be there, but it was also hard, and she was difficult.
Well, that angered Madeline because remember when Boston, this is sort of the story that the rich people would come and they would bring little flasks of alcohol during class, and they'd be pouring themselves cocktails, and then... You know, she would call them the fang ladies with the fingernails, and they would ask some kind of silly, drunkenly, and Madeline just, so this was kind of like repeating itself, so.
Right. It's true.
But I remember Madeline, I met Madeline through her cookbooks in 1975, The Making of a Cook.
Right,
and basically back in those days, I was at the CIA sitting on the library floor, and I opened this book, as there were thousands of books, and this book just sang to me. Because, during that period... we're from the generation where basically, you know, the food was kind of stuck in whatever. It just wouldn't move in any direction.
Right.
I mean, I'd never eaten an avocado in 1975.
Right. Especially
only till I
in
moved
the
to
Northeast.
California. Uh-huh. And so basically I started reading this book, and you know, I had studied at the CIA before, and you know, the CIA was a professional cooking school. And so they would teach you how to make a hollandaise, and they would teach you how to fix a broken hollandaise. But this book is now telling you everything, what happens, why it breaks, et cetera. And so all of a sudden, there's this book available in the 70s that starts talking about food chemistry.
Right.
And so as a child, a student, I wanted to be an artist, and I loved chemistry. And so cooking kind of manifested itself in both of those. So I took a liking to this French woman. So you know, I graduated, fast forward years, and you know, I think you mentioned in the book that it took you, like, she was kept saying, oh, I'm full, 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 Gary. It's three years waiting. You cannot, I'm full, please.
Yes, that's what she talked to.
And so she did the same thing with Joanne. And
she did. She said, I'm full and I can't. I had applied and to study with her. And she said, I'm sorry. She said, there's a three-year waiting list. And I said, I'm getting old. I need to study now. So I waited and waited. And then suddenly one day the phone rang and it was, hello, this is Madeleine. And she said, you got into the, I've made space for you in the class. And can you come? It was like, wait a minute. I mean, I need to like figure this out. So I was living by that time. I was already living in California. So I moved back east again. So I went back to kind of where I'd grown up, and I went to study with her. But I was so excited to go, but it was also hard. I mean, Madeline's class, it was really difficult. We would start at 9 in the morning, and she would lecture for 4 straight hours, and then we would make lunch together. She'd give us this list of ingredients, and we'd have to be creative and come up with menus.
The
creative list is what we called it. We'd come up with a menu, and then we'd cook recipes. And depending upon what we were studying that day, and then we'd cook all afternoon. So we'd probably cook till 6 o'clock and then run a restaurant on the weekend. So we had one day off, Sunday.
It was actually a brilliant way to teach the students the creative list. Like, she would give you like proteins, and she would give you only, and you could only use those things.
Right.
And you had to come up with basically the title of the dish you were doing.
Right.
And then you would discuss it in class, and then you had to write recipes for it. So she,
it was great because it made me learn how I really learned to develop my own style of cooking and what ingredients. And what's interesting is in the book, the carrot and anise soup, which is so funny because since my book's come out, everybody's been making that soup. And that soup was one of the dishes that I came up with the creative list. So there's all these recipes in the book that during the time that I studied with Madeline, and it's still a very special time for me.
It's funny. I got into Madeline's class by pissing her off, basically. Madeline was like the first feminist. She wanted to be the first female chef to move back to France and open a French restaurant and get Michelin stars. She wanted to be the first.
You're right, female.
So I kept calling her to get in, and she's like, "Full, full, full. I'm sorry." And I would call her at the worst time during her son's graduation, during whatever. And so one day I heard through her publicist that one of the women was pregnant and had to stay in bed. And so I jump on the phone, and I am like at wit's end, like, I'm going to get in. And she's like, "I'm full, full, full." And so I think it's because I'm a man. So I say, Madeline, what is the problem here? Is it because I'm a man? And she hits the ceiling, basically tells me I'm full of sheet, and belts out like, the reason I would not let you work in my class is that you are a CIA graduate, and those people give me grief. And I was like, Madeline, I'm a very different breed. I worked in a restaurant under women. My mother taught, I've been trained by women to cook. Yeah. So that's how I got into class. But
that's so great.
You know, I guess you create a good illusion and people come after you. But anyhow, we have a few questions here. All right. Breakfast is my favorite meal. What are your favorite breakfast dishes, and what do you actually eat for breakfast most days?
That's interesting
from both
question.
You and me.
Okay. Well, sometimes it's toast with peanut butter. I have this thing about peanut butter, but you know, I love hot cereal. I really do.
Oatmeal and cooked.
This hot quinoa cereal that I've been loving lately with raisins in it. It's like my favorite thing with almond milk. I know, it's not very exciting. I know you'd like me to say, oh, every day I'm making eggs Benedict and huevos rancheros. And but no.
You know, we were both talking in this away in that, you know, I tend to eat simpler as I get older.
I know, me too.
You know, typically I would have yogurt and growing up in Northeast Corridor, right. You know, like maple syrup. So that is kind of my go-to breakfast. Right. And I like very plain, good yogurt, those type of things. So. Sometimes I love Belinda Leung's Bee Patisserie Queen Amman, which is the most phenomenal pastry in San Francisco,
they're
in my
really
opinion.
Delicious. Me too.
She worked as our pastry chef for 8.5 years, but she called me. We're going to have lunch, so.
Yes.
All right. Anything else you have for breakfast?
No, I think that's it.
I do like granola, too, but.
I do make granola, actually.
Joanne, what type of food do you enjoy cooking the most?
What kind of food?
Food, yes.
You know, it's funny. I've written 17 books about the Mediterranean, and actually 16, and one I wrote about tequila, and I open a Mexican restaurant, which is weird. So, I mean, I love Mediterranean food. Anything that has to do with olive oil, I'm there. I love olive oil. I could drink it. That's probably why I related to Alice Waters so much and love working at Chez Panisse. I love fresh, anything fresh.
And I think that's what your book and your whole philosophy is, that, you know, very simple ingredients that speak for themselves that need very little preparation and stuff. So,
but, you know, when I studied with Madeline, I cooked very much. We cooked very similar. I mean, I made essences, and I don't know. For me, I just always loved, like, just vegetables. When I grew up, my mother would have 12 vegetables on the table. I'm not kidding. Uh-huh. She was obsessed with vegetables. And so I think that's where that whole Joanne Weir gets fresh. And thank you so much for all of you laughing at that. I really appreciate that.
All right. Did you read Yes, Chef?
No, I didn't read it.
Neither did I.
Okay.
Joanne and I were also talking that, you know, we don't tend to run out to the latest, greatest restaurants anymore. We kind of let them settle. And so anyhow.
Yeah.
All right, today we did that one.
Well, I think we're also kind of busy, so it's hard to squeeze it all in.
Okay, we have two questions here.
Okay.
Are there any important ingredients that you think simply can't be duplicated or subbed by locally made versions? How, when do you choose local versus imported?
Oh, I see. I try to use local as much as I can, but I think there are times like...
Jamón.
Oh, yeah, jamón ibérico. Yeah, we both love jamón ibérico.
The best ham in the world, in my opinion.
But no, I mean, there's so many ingredients that come from other countries that are so great like
Parmigiano Reggiano hasn't been reproduced here either.
Right,
you know,
it's
there's
not the same.
Parmesan, but there's certain...
I mean, we have beautiful cheeses here, and those are great, but those are their own thing. And I think there's certain things, and I'm glad you said jamón ibérico.
And American cheeses are incredibly... They are so beautiful, like just the texture.
It's so exciting right now.
Really, you know, Vermont had such amazing cheeses when
I worked. Always, even when I grew up, like the cheddars, and it's really delicious.
So anything you would just can't be duplicated. Well, we chose that, but you know, the flours are different. You know, obviously you're making pasta.
Right.
Or your famous Weirdo.
That's
what I call Joanne's pizza dough.
You know,
Weirdo.
It's so funny. When Gary was, you were at Viognier for a while on the peninsula, and I'll never forget this because he was making pizzas, and I went into one of your cooks said, go get the dough. It's in the walk-in. And I went into the walk-in and I see on it weirdo. So I just tell everybody now, I call my dough Weirdo, and I always tell the story. It's Gary. So
funny. Whoever wrote these questions.
I love that Gary copied things from me. Can you imagine that?
We did use Weirdo pizza. Yes. I think who wrote these was tapping into our conversation today because we had the same...
By the way, we got lost at least... Not lost, but we kept taking the wrong turns because we were talking so much in the car that it took us much longer to get here than we should have. But
we
had to catch up.
Yeah. You know, basically, Joanne and I have not seen each other in basically over a year.
Right.
And so I started to think about...
So this is good. Thank you. Thank you to the Commonwealth Club.
Well, this is also part of the surrogate husband. You know, I feel like we kind of delivered Joanne to Joe.
Yeah, my husband, so...
But, you know, we're friends that we can just pick up and leave off wherever we go and stuff like that. So that's great. All right. Do you have a trick or a tip for great results with the gluten-free version of your recipes?
Wow, that's a great question because I actually have a sensitivity, a gluten sensitivity. And I own a restaurant that's 100% gluten-free. And only because Mexican food is mostly gluten-free, except when you get to the north of Mexico. So that was just a decision we made. You know, No, I mean, I can't really say that I do. I use cup for cup flour, which I think is really great flour.
What is that? That's by who makes that?
Thomas Keller.
Oh, okay.
Came up with that. But and it, there were other people. I think it was his pastry chef, actually. But
is that Red Mills that makes his substitute?
Yeah,
I haven't had
Red
good
Mill?
Luck with that
you
either.
Haven't?
For
and it's really hard. I find that it's really hard just to substitute any other flour and just think it's going to come out the same. I mean, like I made gnocchi not that long ago, and I used cup for cup flour. And they were gnocchi and they held together, but they weren't like, you know, you're using mm-hmm. a good, you know.
Is it trying to make tofurkey? Is that?
Yeah.
Never quite tastes
so
like
So I
turkey.
Hate, I wish I had an answer. And if you have one, let me know. Because, but there's so many great gluten-free things out there.
Well, it now. Also seems like corporate food America. Like I was in the market today and I saw gluten-free chocolate cake mix. So
wow, I know.
So basically a lot of people are addressing that type of thing.
Well, there definitely are problems because there's so much gluten now that's put into our food and our bodies can't digest it.
Well, it's interesting to see, like, you never heard of gluten-free like 10 years ago and all of a sudden it's, and so I don't know, what do you think that is? It the change in flour? And
no, I think it really is the change in flour.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
And Europe as well, like the double zeros.
Okay, so this is interesting because I work a lot in Europe. You know, I every spring and every fall, what I do is I rent villas. Gary's come with me a couple times, but I rent villas and people come and take classes with me. And I was just teaching in October. I was in Marrakesh, Morocco, and I was with my group, and we went out into the mountains, to the Atlas Mountains, and we made bread with the Berber women. And I ate the bread, and I was absolutely fine, and it was so delicious. So now I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to take some flour of theirs next time.
Interesting. The other day I bought some panko and it said on it gluten-free. And I didn't realize that panko is all of it gluten-free? Or?
I think that they make gluten-free panko now.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So it works, you know.
Yeah.
Because, you know, typically in restaurants now you have to have everything available on every level from vegan,
I know,
vegetarian.
It's true. It's true.
And even when we cater and do private parties, we have a separate menu that goes to the far right, so vegan. So.
Wow.
You know, even things like we do a tian with roasted peppers, you know, eggplant, fennel, onion.
Sounds
so
delicious.
So I can now put my panko in there. So.
Yeah, it's true.
So Joan talked about traveling, and so Joan and I have done some traveling together. And
wow.
We taught in the Veneto and Provence.
Right, yes.
And have had some crazy times. I want you to know that being a cooking teacher is not like just getting on the plane and flying there and arriving. You are a flight attendant. You are...
no,
an
you're
an ambulance driver. You are
oh, and
a
I can
shopping
tell you some
consultant.
Stories. I know.
You know. When I was Madeline's assistant in Annecy mm-hmm. in France, where both of us studied as part of our education, where we would actually teach other people that would come in for Madeline's class mm-hmm. how to cook. You know, I used to do all the shopping, and so it's...
I know, I did too.
But anyhow, Joanne and I decided we're going to go to India together.
Yes, we went to India together.
And we're on a like 16-person tour with Sevier Saran, who's
from
cooking
India.
Teacher, restaurateur in New York.
Right.
I thought he was opening in San Francisco.
He's not, fine.
No. But anyhow, we go, we're on this thing.
See, we're still catching up.
And we have Renee Banky from Sur La Table, founder, and then who else was there that we know? Who's our blonde friend from Dallas? Barbara.
Oh, yeah, Barbara's there. She's also in the
Anyhow,
business.
We go, and so Joanne and I are sort of rooming together. And so
we room together.
I'm the one that's kind of the sanitile-ophile, and so I
oh,
have
no,
like...
no, 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 he's got... so much Purell. He's like swapping down the entire room. Like, and then he picked up, I'll never forget this. I hope you don't mind. He picked up the phone. This is the culprit. And also the remote.
Uh-huh.
And he's swabbing it down. But anyway, he also had a complete medical kit. I'm serious. He had a tourniquet. But he's a great person to travel
so
with.
So although we had stayed in very, I mean, some of the
beautiful
best hotels
places.
We stayed
beautiful.
At, the Oberoi in Udaipur was over the top.
And we
incredible.
Said we were going to go back for a week and we haven't gone.
As we head south, we are in that skanky little room, which she's talking about, where I picked up the phone. And
yes, it wasn't quite like the other places. It's true. It wasn't bad, though. It was the best place in the area.
So I have to tease Joanne a little, but part of this book and free to you is that you get to see the hairstyles of Joanne Weir. Through the past 50 years and stuff like that. So
I'm only 50, thank you.
Yes. So anyhow, a story. We both want to have Ayurvedic massages.
All right.
And we've never had the streaming oil on the forehead. So we're in actually a very nice hotel. So, you know, although the oil's streaming on your head and you can
just
smell.
Just imagine my hair.
This smells rancid. Joanne's hair is like sucking up everything. sucking
up. Oh, no. It stayed in my hair for like a week. I couldn't get the oil out of my hair.
May I ask, add rancid oil too? Oh, because we were just like, oh my God.
Oh, please.
So
I pricked up.
But I mean, India was the most incredible place.
It was.
And it is a life-changing.
Very humbling.
You cannot go there without hardening your heartstrings a little.
True.
You have to really be prepared
to
go to India.
It's true. But it was extraordinary. It was so extraordinary. I have to say, though, a lot of the best Indian food I've ever had is here.
Uh-huh.
I really like the food here. But I thought just traveling there was extraordinary.
Well,
was
one thing,
really
you
wonderful.
Want to go there with a group in the beginning. Mm-hmm. The second time, you maybe want to go by yourself. But,
right.
you know, Sevier was even saying in the markets, don't eat this. It's raw right. milk product. It's raw
right,
milk.
Right, right, right.
You know, et cetera. So when you go with a group like that, you end up having the equivalent of the Indian buffet, basically.
Right. We didn't get sick till Vietnam.
But, you know, I have to say that vegetarian food there was always the go-to choice because it was really incredibly,
yeah.
I mean, yeah. And how much sag paneer can you eat?
Right.
As we head down south, remember
then we
that
went
one?
To, yeah.
We then go. Joanne's going to have her first Ayurvedic. You had to go see a doctor or a doctor to get your massage. Remember, he gave you that white powder, that brown powder.
Because like, I had a sinus infection,
it was
so
like
he said, just start
or something,
snorting this. It burns so much. I'm thinking, what am I doing this for? Who knows what this is?
Oh my God.
And the sinus infection didn't go away.
How about the time we went to the antique dealers and they had the...
Gary bought this statue and it arrived. Oh my God. It was very expensive and he bought it and they said, we'll ship it to you. And it came and they had painted
it blue.
Well,
they told me they were
going to
paint it. It was basically my bad. It looked like someone had gone into one of the temples and pried it off, but... They were the most beautiful pieces with the most beautiful
and
patina.
And they painted it.
And they said, we're just going to put, like, you know, water
wash
on it just to make it look tribal because there may be a problem. So I get the piece home. I wash the first one off. It comes off. I wash the big, beautiful ones, you know, the ones with the big, very robust, perky boobs on them.
Right. Okay. You are going to be bleeped left and right.
Anyhow, I start rubbing it off and it doesn't come. Well, come to find out they had painted it with,
blue.
Like...
Blue.
And then there was a time we went to Vietnam, but I'll never forget. We went to a friend of ours restaurant and drinking.
Okay, I'm going to tell this great. Okay, so we had two drinks. We had a first drink. His name is Bobby Chin, and he owns restaurants in Hanoi. And we had the first drink. Have you been there? Somebody's like shaking their head. And we had the second drink. And at the end, I was like, wow, I feel really good, Bobby. These are incredible. He said, yes, we put Valium in each one.
So we then get on scooters.
And then we're going to ride.
We're all on we have a driver and we're in the back of a scooter.
We each have our own scooter. We've got a driver. So we're going to hang on tight, he said. And we're like, okay. We're like real going around corners. Oh,
and
my.
Then we end
I will
up in
never
that,
forget,
that
Bobby.
That restaurant that reminded me we're in the middle of a subway.
Oh, please.
It felt like that. And
except the food was the most delicious food, and we all got sick, but it was really delicious food.
And we're with Renee Banky. She has to go to the bathroom, and she's like, I asked for the bathroom, and they took me to the
kitchen.
Storm drain kitchen. And she said,
they turned off the light in the kitchen and pulled the curtain and said, that's where you go. I'll never forget.
I have to
that.
Say the next morning was the worst day of my life. We both woke up and we're like, what happened? Like,
we just,
oh my God,
awful,
it's so
awful.
Crazy.
Anyway.
So Joanne and I have laughed through a few continents.
I know. We have. So we've been to Italy, France, India, and Vietnam, and a lot in the U.S.
Oh my God, crazy. All right, if you were to cook a whole turkey for a family dinner, did you not get enough turkey for Thanksgiving?
No.
How would you cook it? Drumsticks off separately, dressing in turkey?
Oh, Gary.
I'm the master of this one, Sister Mary. So.
Okay, you do yours. You want to?
Basically, what I do is I deconstruct it, which means I take the breast, I take the whole turkey, I take the legs off, and then I take the breast and I bone them from backwards so you end up with the two lobes connected. And then I basically, keeping the skin intact, I tie it into a neat little bundle. And then I put that in the refrigerator. Mm-hmm. And then I take the legs and I basically take this the drumstick out, thigh stick, and then I tie it. I've brined the turkey before that. And what I do is I roast it basically the night before.
Right.
And so what that does, and I take all the bones and I make my stock. So I have the breast in the refrigerator. I have the roasted thing. I then take it, cool the meat on it. I slice it. I actually take my little food saver, Cryovac, and I Cryovac that. Mm. So I make all of my my basic stock, skim that, and then basically I get my love, which is what we call all those drippings from the bottom of the pan that the legs were in. That is where all the flavor is. So then I make my gravy and I flavor it with that. Day of, I roast the turkey breast to approximately 135, 140. Mm-hmm. I dip my little bags of meat into my simmering water of 140 or above, and then basically let my breast rest, and I slice it. Gravy's already made. Boom, presto. And what it does, it takes all that sort of last minute, you know, skimming, straining, that type of thing. So I don't know how you do it.
Oh, you know, I brine a turkey for, it depends upon the size, but I brine it for a couple of days and then I dry it in the oven. And I cook my turkey whole and I make a double or a triple turkey stock, which I take the fond at the bottom of the, you know, I pour off the fat and then I make the... I hate to call it gravy, but because gravy. I really, it's more of a sauce. But anyway, I make it with the double or triple turkey stock, and it's great, delicious, delicious. Oh, I know one other thing I do. I'm sorry. While it's roasting in the oven, I take a piece of cheesecloth and I drench it in butter and I put it over the top, so you don't even have to baste.
Beautiful.
Mine's pretty simple.
You know, the Italians call red sauce gravy too. So
yeah, I know it's true.
All right, Joanne, here's the one. Pick your favorite child.
Okay.
You've been a chef, cookbook author, restaurateur, cooking teacher, and TV show host. Which role is your favorite?
You know, we were kind of talking about that on the way over. I'm a person who, I love everything I do. I love all the different things. I think if I did just one, it wouldn't be good for me. I'm probably ADD or something. But I love having a restaurant? I'll tell you, that's the hardest thing I've done. But also pretty rewarding. I'm really a teacher first, and I think that's why in my show I always have a student, and it's really important to me that I continue to, that people continue to cook and that I inspire people in the kitchen. So I'd say being a teacher would be number one.
That's great.
And I like doing television, but that's me being a teacher again. So
Joanne and I both enter a restaurant in a very different angle. I enter as a child working. You know, from age 12 on into the, and so, Joanne, as you get, you just opened a restaurant a few years ago.
At this age?
As you're getting into it, I'm wanting to ease out.
Right. I know, I think I was crazy. So what happened was I wrote one book about tequila because I, you know, many chefs love tequila and I happen to like tequila. I'm not like, you know, slamming back shots, but I like tequila. And so I wrote a book about tequila because I didn't really see information out there and what I was looking for. And so I wrote this book and I was on a very well-known restaurateur's boat. His name is Larry Mindell. And I was on his boat off the coast of Mexico. He has this beautiful yacht. And so I was there and I handed him my book and I said, you know, I want to give you this gift. He goes, tequila, that's my favorite spirit. I make the best margarita. And I was like, I make the best margarita. So anyway, we had this competition and he made me his and I made him mine. And guess who won? Anyway, he said, you know, I gave him mine. It's very simple. The recipe's in the book, but it's really three ingredients. And I gave it to him and he said, that's the best margarita I've ever had. And he said, if I ever found the location to open a Mexican restaurant, would you open it with me?
Three margaritas to the wind, yes.
I had just had a couple of margaritas. I was like, sure, what a great idea. Because really on my bucket list was I thought, you know, I'd be great opening a restaurant. Little did I know, like three chefs later. And what happened was the chef quit. He quit a week before we opened. And we had gotten so much press. And when the doors opened, seriously, the people were like running in the door. And that very first day, there were 500 people. And I was back in my chef's jacket, seriously, with guacamole up to my elbows and making ceviche. And it was not exactly what I thought. I thought I was going to be there with like cute clothes, walking around saying, how is everything? How is everything tonight? How is everything? And instead, I seriously was making guacamole. But anyway, I am finally... wearing those cute clothes and walking around. So, no, I'm just so happy now because we've finally to a point where...
And ready to open your next location, huh?
Yeah, right. You never know. You might be in a neighborhood near you.
Okay. My favorite restaurant is truly Gary Danko. Well, thank you.
Oh, yeah.
Other than GD, where do you both enjoy dining?
Okay, well,
I love
Chez Panisse. Mm-hmm. I will always. I mean, I go through these phases when I have to eat there. Are you going to say Zarzuela?
What's that?
Were you going to say Zarzuela?
I love Zarzuela,
too.
I haven't
been
there in a while.
I haven't been in a long time either, but there's a Spanish place in the city that's great. I still love Kokkari. I really love Kokkari. Well, I love
been there in a while either.
Modern, you know, what upscale Greek food. I love anything from the Mediterranean.
What was our favorite Sardinian restaurant we used to go to all the time at the end of Church Street?
Oh, I love it still. La Chicha.
La Chicha.
I'm actually going there in a
week.
And they
opened a second one, right?
Yes, they opened La Nebbia, which means the fog.
One of my secret restaurants in San Francisco, and I want you to go eat there, but is South Park Cafe.
Oh, South Park.
Do you know Wade?
I haven't been there for a
long time. Oh, my God.
He's
incredible. He is still cooking at the stove.
Is it great?
I love it there.
I have to go.
They have, like, such an affordable menu, and it's just heartwarming, like bistro food like you would get in France.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, he studied in France. So.
Yeah.
All right.
South Park. See?
Here's a good one. Other than Madeline Kamen, who else inspired you?
I would have to say my mother and Alice Waters. So those would be my three mentors. That's what I write about in the end of the book is really the people that, and it's three women who really have been.
And I also took.
And Gary Danko, of course.
I also took that three grains of salt to be the three inspired, because I have my three M's also. Mom. Right. And when I was like, started working at age 12 as a hat check boy in upstate New York, I eventually worked in the restaurant under Mabel Seatcott.
Oh, yeah.
Feisty Irish gal, and then Madeline Kamen. So the three M's were very important to me. And, you know, Madeline was, I had already trained and worked in the industry and, you know, degree from the CIA, but Madeline acted really as a finishing school.
Right.
And I don't know if you guys have ever heard of Madeline Kamen, probably one of the most under-realized
and you know what,
cookbook
Gary,
authors in the history of America.
One of the books I think we should tell them about that you really should look for is called When French Women Cook. And that really inspired me with my book of really thinking about the women that have influenced me. But these are the women that influenced Madeline in her life. And it's just the chapter about Magali, I write about her in the book. Madeline's book, that's a really great one.
You know, basically it's about her, as you know, she grew up in Paris, and as the war raged on, they moved their children to different aunts around the region. And so the book really writes about the food of each woman and different parts of her life. So it's very, and also if you want to really know, and I would recommend this to any professional chef is, you know, the making of a cook
is
the
great.
Rewrite, actually.
Yes. Yeah.
If you remember, I told you the first book that she wrote was like this big, and the one I first met her through in the library at the CIA, she rewrote it later after she was running the School for American Chefs.
Right.
And, you know, it's not one of those light books you lug to the beach.
Right.
It's thick, you know.
You can lug mine to the beach.
Joan, I have to say that your book is really beautifully done.
Thank
the photographs,
you.
The recipes, you know, incredible.
It was great. You know, I really had said I'm not writing another book. I've written enough books. People have enough of my recipes. And then Margot True from Sunset Magazine, she used to be with Savoir Magazine. She's the food editor now at Sunset. Said, would you come to, you know, meet with me and talk about your next book or talk about a book together? And I said, yeah, but I'm not thinking about another book. And she said, oh, just come in. And I met with she and Peggy Northrup, who's the editor-in-chief. And they talked about, like, what their idea of my next book was. And I was like, it was California, you know, kind of going, being very much a part of the California food movement. And they said, what do you think about that? And I started talking. And I was like, I didn't even have an answer. And they said, well, what book would you like to write? And I started talking. I write about this in the book. I started talking about my grandfather and my grandmother on my father's side and the sauerkraut and stealing sauerkraut out of the big crock and the pickles that she made and, you know, just the working with Madeline. And, and I have to say the chapter that's called There's a Fly in My Wine. Can I tell that story?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I'll keep it short, but it's really a fun story. Okay, so anyway, that they said, you know, well, that's the book we want you to write. So that's why. And anyway, there's 250 photos. When they showed me the other book that they had just worked on, I was like, oh my God, I want to work with you. They were the best publisher I could have ever asked for because it's really my book. It was, you know, when you open the book, the pages on the inside, they look like Morocco, and they really let it be my book. So it was really very special for me. But anyway, A Fly in My Wine, I do have to tell that story. And when I grew up, I went to the school at the University of Massachusetts, and then I moved to Boston. And when I moved into my first apartment in Cambridge, the person that was moving out, I happened to know him, and he gave me a bottle of wine, which happened to be a bottle of Mouton Cadet. And some people probably know it. Well, it was a really expensive bottle then. It was $6 a bottle. Anyway, so we drank the bottle. I had moved in with my friend Charlotte, who Gary knows, and she's still a really close friend of mine. And we moved. It took us, we were just unpacking, and we opened the bottle of wine, and it took us two nights to drink the bottle of wine. You can see it's very different than probably today, that it would only take us one night. But anyway, the second night, I looked in my glass, and clinging to the inside of the glass was a fly. And it was definitely like, it was just surrounded with red wine. So it was a time when I remember I had gotten a box of dried apricots, and one had a stone in it. So I wrote to the company, and what happened was I got two boxes of dried apricots in the mail. I thought, this is incredible. I'm just going to wrap this fly up in aluminum foil and send it back to where it came from. Well, I wrapped it up and sent it to Chateau Mouton Rothschild, which happens to be the top winery in the world. And they sent back, there were no faxes then. They sent back a telex saying, this has never happened to us. If you ever happen to be in France, we want you to be our special guest for lunch. Well, I decided, I was a school teacher in Boston teaching fine arts in high school. It was my summer vacation, and I bought a ticket immediately. Charlotte and I went to France. We wanted to collect, right? We'd had this fly in a bottle of wine. So we get to Chateau Mouton Rothschild, and we've got on our Diane von Furstenberg wraparound dresses. So that lets you know the era, right?
Remember the hairdo, too.
Oh, the hairdo.
Yes.
And I had on the blue version, and she had the green version. Same exact dress. But we had matching espadrilles. I had the blue, she had the green. And we walked across the stones, and we were met by these two incredibly handsome exporting agents. And my date for the day, I guess, was this guy whose name was Xavier Desaguerre. And he had on this white linen suit, and oh my God, was he handsome. Oh, so we had this lunch that was extraordinary, and the story is there, and all the recipes are there, but even the menu is there. It's in the book. I save everything, so that's why they could put 250 photos in the book. But anyway, we had this menu that was unbelievable, and we started with Chateau Mouton Rothschild from 1966, and then we had 1944. Next was 1922, and then they brought out this strawberry tart, fresh strawberry tart, that was so beautiful, and we had Chateau de Cam. And I had read everything I could before I left. I knew about wine, and I knew, you know, that Pinot Noir and Chardonnay came from Burgundy, and I knew what came from Bordeaux, and I knew what grapes came from Alsace. Anyway, so we were, by now, seriously, I'm absolutely fluent in French. And I'm talking away, and we're drinking this, and they're saying, what do you think of the wine, the Chateau de Cam? Well, we started with 1918, then we went to 1902, and the last one we had was from 1892. And even Xavier was like, they never bring out these wines. My favorite line of the entire day was, he said, we were really young. I was 24 years old, and he said, wow, we thought you were going to be really old women, like 40. He was all of 30. He was just seemed so. Anyway, we left, and he put his hand across my face, and he said, I'll see you again. I never saw him again. But I did see him in that movie. It's called something de Monde. Vin de Monde. I can't even remember the name of the movie.
Oh, he was in a movie?
He was in a movie.
Oh, really?
He didn't age well. I just want you to know. So honestly, I want to find Xavier because I know he left Chateau Mouton. He just retired from there recently. A really good friend of mine worked with him for years and said he left Chateau Mouton. But I still want to send him the book because I think he'll love the story. And I hope to God he remembers us in our Diane von Furstenberg dresses.
And there's a picture of him there too, right?
There is a picture of him in there. It was an and there's a picture of me looking very drunk. I really looked drunk. Oh, by the way, the last thing we did, Charlotte and I got in the car. We should never have been driving. We had this little rented Mini, and we rolled down the windows, and we drove to Barrett's with the windows rolled down, singing old Beatles songs as loud as we possibly could. Anyway, that was a time people didn't even talk about, you know.
You seem to have sang the Beatles a lot in your...
Yes. Oh, yeah. No, that was Silent Night. You've got to read the story.
Yes, that was my closing line, but anyhow, we'll save that. No, all right, we have another question. What is the biggest mistake most of us make when we cook? And that's to both of us.
You know.
You've been in cooking classes with many people, right?
I think not seasoning, and people are afraid of salt. That's what you would say the same, I'm sure, right?
My funniest thing is when people cook is that they love to just stir and stir and stir.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They play with the food. It's true. Or they set their timers. They set a timer when it says 30 seconds. I'm like, just kind of, you can do it in your mind. It's okay. To 1,001.
You know, the reality when you're learning to cook is that, you know, it embraces all of your senses, your eyes, your nose, your mouth, your ears, your touch.
And all your senses. It's true.
And you really learn that when you go to another country because the products are different there. And you have to really, like, if you're beating, you know, a Genoise, you know, when it's ready by the foaming and stuff, you know, you just can't put it on the mixer and say, basically, this is...
You know, that's interesting. I just wrote a story for Washington Post, and I wrote about cooking with your five senses, but I actually called it cooking with your six senses because your sixth is really common, common sense. And I think that's also one of our senses, but it's so true what you're saying.
You know, when you're cooking in a professional kitchen, you're multitasking all over the place. You know, you've got essences going, which are basically little cubes of meat simmering in their veal stock to make, you know, and as it gets down, because the principle is to reduce it down to a glaze and caramelize it a little more, but your ears can hear it cooking. And so you basically have to train yourself to that. Mm-hmm. Other things I find, like, you know, people will prep their vegetables and then they'll put the water on. You know, put the water on first, put it on while you're bringing it to a boil, and prep your vegetables. And so, you know, there are little tips like that can make your cooking a little more efficient and stuff like that.
It's really true.
One of my things I love about professional cooking is cooking with a scale, because you don't have to use a measuring cup. You put something on a container, you hit tear, you pour it in there, you hit tear again, you put your next one in, you've dirtied one container. So,
and it's also really great for baking, for sure.
Okay. Am I supposed to read this radio reminder here? I think so. Basically, at this point, I'd like to remind our radio audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. I'm Chef Gary Danko, your moderator for tonight's program. Our guest is Chef Joanne Weir, discussing her latest cookbook, Kitchen Gypsy. I jokingly said she stole the title from Cher, but I don't know.
Kitchen Gypsy, recipes and stories from a lifelong romance with food. You know, you kind of have that.
Did you ever think that cooking would lead you to where you are today?
Did I? That's an interesting question. You know, no. Really, the honest answer, no. Did you?
No, you know, when I started cooking, it was not a very highly revered profession. Right. And so your parents, you know, most parents wanted you to be a doctor, a lawyer, whatever. And cooking was something you did at a vo-tech school. Right. And you either took hairdressing, plumbing, electrical.
Or cooking.
And I went to Catholic school, so I couldn't go to vo-tech. So I ended up working in a restaurant.
Right.
But it's very interesting, though.
No, I think that that's true. I didn't think so. You know, I didn't even think about it after I got out of high school, like to go to even go to cooking school. It was definitely my parents. We had to go to college. We went to college.
All right. Do we have any more questions? We only have a few minutes left. So anything you want to get into before?
Let's see how much fun it was. What do you think about, like, I mean, I think it's opening a restaurant. Everybody thinks it's such a glamorous job.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think anybody knows how hard it is to open a restaurant or how to be consistent in the restaurant, how to keep people. I mean, the restaurant right now, there are so many. We have more restaurants per capita in San Francisco than any city in the United States. Uh-huh. And trying to find skilled people is difficult.
Well, you know, also new generation are different than we are. They have different needs and wants. And so, you know, as we grew up, we basically worked, you know what, we used to do 120 covers with three cooks.
Right.
Now you do it with like eight cooks and, you know, six stages and stuff. So, you know, obviously the food has changed and gone upward, but, you know, it's just a very, very different world. So,
No, it's true. I remember when I first moved to San Francisco, you know, there were so, you know, you knew with the few restaurants that you wanted to go to and you wanted to eat. Now it's hard to like keep up.
Well, as you know, the hardest part about running a restaurant is the human resource aspect. Just, you know, anytime there are people, and that's very challenging. And then also just the sort of escalating cost of doing business these days, because, you know, everything is changing. And I think everybody here can probably admit everything costs more than it did last year and sort of climbing that way. But
well, yeah, opening Copita for me was definitely, as I said, a challenge when we had all those people, like they were out the door. And I went through three chefs. I write about this in the book. And every single time I had a difficulty, you know, the chef would leave or whatever would happen. Larry, my partner in the restaurant, And some of you probably know his restaurants. He started, he was the first one to have a pizza oven in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. He had it at Prego. Do you remember Prego?
I do remember Prego.
That was Larry's restaurant. He started Il Fornaio and he owns Poggio. But anyway, he would say things like, when one door closes, another one opens. And I think, okay. And I seriously, it was definitely the most stressful thing I've done.
I
never, ever had a single gray hair.
You
but
still
now,
don't, right?
Thank you.
We've got one last set of questions. Any advice for those of us just learning to cook?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I was just doing an event at Lucas Films, and a woman came up to me and she said, I never, ever cooked before I watched your show. Because I really feel like it's important to continue to cook. And I'm so afraid that people aren't going to be cooking, you know, that they're not going to spend time in the kitchen. And it really bothers me that people don't cook at home. And so I think it's really important. But I think if you find a book that you like and you can master a recipe and it gives you confidence, it's really all about confidence. And if you learn just a few tricks, whether it's ribboning egg yolks and sugar or you learn whisking egg whites, that opens up a whole new group of recipes that you can do. And so I think it's just learning some of those terms and then mastering them. But I really do think, like, keep it simple. It doesn't have to be complicated. I think that's the best way to eat. And you can always go to Gary Danko and have him cook complicated food.
And I would say basically just take a recipe, jump in, and don't be afraid of it. You know, one thing that Julia Child, who is a good friend of both of ours, you know, she made American cooks feel confident. And if you made a mistake, it wasn't the end of the earth.
I know.
So basically, you just build off of your experience. You try something, you like it. I mean, it's like trying to find the ultimate chocolate cake. How many recipes have you done until you found the one? You probably had one as a child because you wrote about it. But, you know, we had one, but you're always finding those ones. And once you establish a recipe, you like keep it as, you know, your base and then start moving on to other ones. Ooh, the questions are pouring in here. Is there a specific scale for you recommend? Do you have a scale?
I use that. Is it Scholey?
Uh-huh, that's one of them.
Yeah, that's an excellent scale, actually. That's the one I use.
You know, it depends on, you know, you have to make sure you buy one that it goes up to the poundage that you want. Say you put a 8-ounce dish on it, it only goes to 2 pounds. You're going to be a little limited.
I also like it to be both in metric and
exactly, in grams. And
And the other is ounces and pounds.
Ounces and pounds, yeah. So I have one that goes up to 65 pounds because we use much larger things. Right. But scales are so inexpensive from what they used to be. I mean, it's incredible. You can buy the one I have for $65 and stuff.
Yeah.
So
I think they're usually, they're probably about that.
Okay, I'm going to jump over here. What is your number one spice you couldn't live without? Exclude salt and pepper.
Number one spice I couldn't live without. I can tell you the ones I love. Like right now, I just love coriander, ground coriander.
I
love coriander. I don't know what it is.
Also cumin.
I love
it
cumin.
Like
I was
going to
say, but some people say that. But I love it. When people say they don't like cumin, I don't understand. But I really love it. But
you could say curry and cover a lot of them.
Yeah, you could. Yeah, exactly.
Any advice? Okay, favorite food city, Joe, in the world.
San Francisco. No, I am so lucky because I teach in the Mediterranean. So I teach in Morocco, Spain, Provence, south of France, Italy, and Greece. And so for me, I love all that food from the Mediterranean. But I think because we have such great ingredients that and we have the same climate, we're at the same parallel. I think the food that we have in San Francisco is fantastic. And sorry, I love New York. But I love our food in San Francisco, and I love our proximity to the wine country. Mm-hmm. I think we're very, very, very lucky people.
I agree. Chicago has good food, too.
It does have good food.
Very good. So.
Still love San Francisco.
All right, Joanne, here's one. How do you stay so slim?
Oh, my goodness. I love you, whoever
when
wrote that.
When food is your focus.
I eat everything. I'm not kidding. I really eat, and I'm really hungry right now, actually. I really am. But I do work out. I do. I walk, or I do Pilates. I walk. I walk to the gym. I do like exercise machines. I also I do yoga, and that's what keeps me so calm.
Don't you find as you're Don't you find as you're tasting food all day that you're not wanting to sit down to a meal and just
Yeah, kind of. You know what the other thing I was thinking before, Gary, when we were talking about cooking, I think sometimes what happens to people, and it happens to me, when you don't cook for a while, don't you think sometimes, like with your timing and everything? So that's why I say to people, keep cooking, don't stop, because even if you stop for a couple weeks, it really
you
does.
Lose it, yeah.
You do lose mm-hmm. it a little bit, like anything. Uh-huh. And I don't know where that came from, but anyway.
All right, here's one. Are you both in your restaurant on a daily basis doing hands-on cooking?
I taste all the time. I taste every single dish, and I'm always there. I mean, I probably go 3 to 4 days a week, and a lot of times I'm there. I'm always there on Friday night, walking around with those clothes on, smiling, saying, how is everything?
I stay out of the dining room.
I know that about you.
And for
Gary's
me,
shyer than I am.
Well, I have other reasons, too, we talked about, but... But anyhow, you know, basically, as far as me, I sort of made a pact when I got into my 15th year of the restaurant, which we are now 16, that I would slowly kind of ease out of it. And I kind of eased out of being there every day into right. doing mostly out of the house events now, because we do a lot of catering. So that's kind of my new project. Also, there is a step in as you transform from chef to restaurateur, you acquire so many other duties, like
wow.
the human resources. Right. And although you have accounting people, you're still having to check invoices and doing those type of things. So, you know, in Gary Danko, like Copita is open 7 days a week, so, and only closed 4 days a year. So you're pretty much doing all of these type of things. So, all right, I guess we have wrapped up this session. And so, unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where we already answered the last question. our thanks to Joanne Weir, chef, thank cooking you. Instructor, television host, and cookbook author, for discussing her latest book, Kitchen Gypsy, Recipes and Stories from a Lifetime Romance with Food, here with us tonight. We also want to thank our audience here on the radio and online, and the Bernard Osher Foundation and Wells Fargo for underwriting and sponsoring this program. I'm Gary Danko, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of America is adjourned.
Woo. Thank you. Thanks, right. everyone. Thank you. Thank you.